Next case is 99-496, George Donnelly versus David Heron.
What am I doing? This is a really good article. So it's about legal writing.
Yeah, all right.
I'm track mine.
Let me start you before you have a chance to speak with a threshold question.
Where's the title?
As I read the record here, from
the trial court
here denied, overruled a motion for summary of judgment, and there was an appeal from that denial of summary judgment. Is that correct, or am I misreading?
It was an appeal from a judgment entered for $12,500 as a result of
Okay, in the brief, someplace, I don't know, you might have known, someplace the brief indicated that the appeal was taken from the summary judgment, and I happily filed an appeal with the Tioga County Court of Appeals regarding the trial court's denial of the motion for summary judgment.
That's true. That was the issue on appeal only after a money judgment was entered.
Okay, so we have a final appeal order ahead of us.
Indeed, we do. May I please reserve 3 minutes?
Yes. Watch your time on the clock.
I'm very careful. Fellow justices of the members of the court, I represent George Donnelly. He was injured while he was in the course of his employment. And he received an injury that arose out of it. The issue for all of you is whether Ohio Revised Code Section 4123.741 applies to his fellow employee who was not on the clock performing services for the employer. This area of the law is more confusing than what I heard in the first appellate argument today as it relates to interpreting those statutes. This appeal is the mixing of the concept of zone of danger to afford a worker in Ohio compensation when they are not at their fixed site of employment with an analysis that requires one to determine whether the employee tortfeasor seeking immunity was truly in the service of the employer.
Unless you're an intentional force, if you get workers' comp, you can't sue anyway.
Well, because then, if a person like in the Carroll case was at work and got hurt because a product was defective,
That's different. Because you have an employer and an employee, you've got no employment issues, and the whole thing came out of the employment issues. You got a self-servant who, in your book, was not on the clock, but you still leaving work, no new point, whatever you call it. But your guy got workers' comp. And if we start opening the door to the area you suggested, aren't we getting away from the trade-off of the basis for workers' comp?
Not at all. And here's why. The legislature never intended Mr. Heron, under these circumstances, to be immune for his admitted negligence. He wasn't in at the sites of the employment at all. And he admitted in his deposition on pages 9 and 10, the sites of the employment with the guard check. Now, when this accident happened, because he was standing. Excuse me, John.
Why would he get working comp?
Because
on one hand, but you don't want to give on the other hand.
Well,
my guy was working, but.
If my client was an innocent third party, Mr. Heron wouldn't be able to, the statute of protective services, Mr. Heron's employer, would not have to respond in damages for Mr. Heron's conduct under the circumstances of this case, because Mr. Heron wasn't acting in a way to benefit the employer. There is no respondeat superior in that simple sense that I'm proposing. behalf of Mr. Donnelly in this case, that if you're going to immunize an employee who's not in the service of his employer, you must consider the repercussions of that, just like in the Sinus case, where Justice Cook wrote the opinion and indicated that in that assault situation, no one was entitled to workers' compensation. But under the analysis put forth by the appellee in this case, the employee doing the assaulting would be entitled to immunity because he was under a contract of employment. And because we shouldn't focus on the circumstances and precise nature of the activity that occurs at the time the injury happens due to the negligence of the tortfeasor employee who's not in the service of the employer. It's not a tough test, it's not difficult, and it's not unfair given the fact that work comp in no way gives full and complete compensation to an individual injured by the negligence of another. It was never meant to. And the trade-offs that occurred may very well apply in a purely an employment situation, but when a third party also injures that worker, this court has countenanced time and time again under a variety of circumstances to assure full and complete compensation, additional claims. And that's all we're asking for here.
Isn't your argument that your client was in the scope of his employment, the defendant was not?
Well, no.
Isn't that why your client got workers' comp? That was never an issue in the workers' comp.
I wouldn't go that far. The statute doesn't require that Mr. Herring, the immunity-seeking employee, be in the course of his employment or that the injury arose out of his activities. The statute doesn't say that. Legislature didn't require it. All the legislature required is that Mr. Herring be in the service of the employer. So the simple test would be to, every time an employee seeks immunity under the statute, analyze whether the activity at the time the injury occurs due to that employee's action is such that it could bind the employer under principles of respondeat superior in the service of.
Why does that not bring up all our cases on whether you are the scope of your employment, not service, the scope of employment when you're in the parking lot or coming and going, and which is an issue here?
It's not an issue here. Because it is admitted that Mr. Donnelly was in the course of his employment, that his injuries arose out of his employment. And what we're suggesting here in no way questions that rationale, which follows the constraints of the statutory scheme to apply a liberal construction to afford benefits to the worker. That's exactly what this court has done from Marlowe on through its progeny. And which it steps back.
Which the argument would be the same as if Mr. Karen was, if they were both working in this accident occurred.
If Mr. Herring indeed was in the service of his employer, my argument would be that I wouldn't be here because I wouldn't be seeking compensation beyond workers' compensation. Unless, of course, we started addressing the concerns in Blankenship in the footnote about whether an intentional report could be drafted upon an employee. And I don't want to go there. And that's not where I'm going.
You're here because Mr. Herring was not in the storm.
Right. And that's exactly right. And I'm here because if I were walking across the street and my law firm hit me on Saturday, I don't think my law firm ought to have immunity.
But he wouldn't, because the statute requires that before the immunity is triggered, it requires that the injured employee be in the course of his employment. You were. You were the guy, and you received comp. You would receive comp, workers' comp.
I would, mm-hmm. Under those circumstances, and under the reason that the defendant, the law firm would be immune, which is incongruous, and really is not at all what the Constitution required that the court be open for the compensation.
Two things, though, Mr. Alkire. The words that you're focused on, and the only words that give you an argument here are those words in the service of. Sure. And yet, you know, the argument is, we know the General Assembly uses a phrase in the course and scope to define what I think you're equating in the service within this course and scope.
That's not true.
Well, let me go on. And so you can answer the whole thing at once. You know, to it seems the argument of the other side, and one that seems to have some merit, is that in the service of, how else is the General Assembly going to define somebody who's a co-employee? They had to get a phrase for that. They used in the service of an employer. And when you go off the clock, sure as heck you're not in the course and scope, but are you nevertheless still an employee defined as somebody who is an employee of such employer? The definition is that you are in the service of, just meaning you are an employee.
Let me address that directly.
Yeah, that's the question.
Could be, in some circumstances, I can envision going to the time clock when I worked in a factory making rope coating on 80th and Franklin. And on my way out, I moved a cart out of, after I punched out, I moved a cart out of the way so that it wouldn't interfere with my coworkers on the next shift. And that benefits the employer. And if I hurt someone negligently while I was moving that cart, I ought to get a beauty.
But you're always,
not this case.
But you're going to course and scope issues right there.
Well,
were you?
I'm going to in the service issues.
But, okay, it's all about the definition. Yeah, it's all about the definition, what the General Assembly meant by in the service. And did they mean that to equate with in the course and scope?
Well, I'll tell you, my best explanation of that is to read Judge Abood's opinion, which I thought was very, very scholarly and complete, which analyzed thoroughly what in the service means and why a court ought to engage in construing that, because in and of itself, as stated, it can be somewhat ambiguous. So we enter into a situation here where the General Assembly didn't help us and make it clear. Now, we can't ignore that language. Rules of statutory construction require us to give them meaning.
It's job security for us.
Well,
the right language like that.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Although $12,500 doesn't pay the bills entirely, but it's the principle. If we have horseplay, why would there be fellow servant immunity? There wouldn't be, and that's what Cagle stands for. If there's an assault, why should the assaulter get immunity? Of course, he or she shouldn't. And why? Because when they're engaged in that act,
no,
they're not in the service.
That's not why. It's not because it's because they didn't meet the other two criteria, not in the scope and not receiving comp.
You're thinking about the injured party.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the situation where the injured party chooses to sue the assaulter, and the assaulter says, hey, I'm immune. I'm not thinking about the injured party.
Said,
you are, and that's why you must be at the language where injury is defined as occurring in the course of and arising out of. No question about that.
One other thing.
Not the analysis the legislature required when it defined immunity.
And they want it, should we just define immunity broadly to help employees? I mean, the whole idea of this statute is to protect the fellow who worked with you at the roof, you know, company, who doesn't want to get sued by you because he backed into you.
You should define it narrowly. The way Justice Sweeney talked about it in Nobles, who cited a long line of Supreme Court cases which require that rule of construction.
That's interesting because, you know, it would depend on which way you look at it, whether it should be broadly or narrowly for the benefit of employees in the state.
The benefit of the employees.
You think the protection of the tortfeasor. Yeah. You think it's protection of the tortfeasor. If we're looking at it as a protection for tortfeasors, we should make it narrow.
But the liberal construction is a statutory one that's required to afford benefits.
Yeah.
That's what Fisher says. We're not talking about affording benefits here to Mr. Don or to anyone. We're talking about whether one ought to escape the responsibility for the consequences of his negligence. And if we're going to afford that immunity, we ought to follow the strict meaning of the statute, which circumscribes one's rights to get full, fair, and complete compensation.
And where it goes after that is if you apply the fellow servant rule, grant immunity to the fellow servant, and it's a negligence case like happened in the parking lot, as I recall it, in Nobles versus Wolf, then you go to your company and say, oh, he's uninsured because he's immune. Oh, no, he's insured, he's just immune. So the insurance company doesn't pay either.
Well, corporate.
That's why you get into with these cases.
You do, and you could look at whether he's going, whether he's coming, whether he's...
Your strongest argument is he's not in the service. Why was he not in the service?
Because he wasn't doing anything that benefited the employer. He wasn't doing anything employment-related. He didn't need to have a car. He didn't operate a car.
Where did this occur?
This occurred in the Avis parking lot. He was employed by Saggio Protected Services.
But he worked there. He worked at Avis.
He worked at the guard shack. Pages 9 and 10 of this deposition made it clear what the site of his employment was. That protective service did not have to read the contract on the way out to make sure that the contract matched the car. Now, that...
responsibility for watching the car.
There's one statement that on page 17 he talks about suspicious activity. There's nothing in the record which indicates this man or Mr. Donovan ever departed their post to do anything. There's no evidence in the record to support an idea that there's any control exercised by Saggio over that parking lot.
Let me switch it around. Your client, who had parked next to the guard shack, was leaving and was injured.
Now, you want to know if my client injures himself while he's negligent?
No. If your client finishes the shift, locks out, gets in the car, parks next to the guard shack on the main parking lot, and is pulling out somebody, a customer coming in, hit him. Your client can go.
Well, I'll tell you. Before NCD,
no.
I think the answer would have been clearly he's in the zone of his employment. After MTV, I'm not so sure.
But you certainly would argue he was.
Your Honor, this Justice Stratton, if this person walked into my office and I felt that there was a way to make law to his benefit, I'd try like heck. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Barrett, just to be clear.
Good morning, may it please the court. I was going to begin with, or by reminding the court that the statute does not require Mr. Herring to prove that he was in the course of his employment in order to claim immunity. That point was conceded in appellant's arguments.
So, counsel, what I'm curious about is change the facts in this case and move. To a situation in which your client is driving, or maybe to pick up and do this, like we take the he's not in the zone of his employment. He is a federal employee, and he enters.
Versus North case and it's the Web case.
While the plaintiff is in doing his job,
his employment.
That's part of his employment. They work for the same company, but your client is clearly, this is day off, and he somehow comes in contact with a fellow employee who is working and injures that person unintended. Immunity under the statute?
In the simple scenario, if I may, just a slight twist of the fact in this case. Suppose my client was at that Avis rental car lot because he had just rented a car for some private purpose. He backed it up and strikes his co-employee. I would say clearly that would be a situation that transcends the boundary of industrial relations and cannot be intended, or the legislature could not have intended immunity to apply in that case. That's not this case.
So is your argument so simple as to say that when one employee flies under workers' comp, that employee cannot sue the tort either?
I think that you are paraphrasing the statute correctly. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be read that way. I think common sense tells us that the legislature probably didn't intend this immunity to apply in situations that go well beyond these people's employment relationship to one another.
Well, it's
only
the injured.
If they meet one another because of that employment relationship, then I think we have to look at the immunity issue.
It only is triggered when the injured employee is in the scope and receives comp. So it naturally has the statutory scheme requires that relationship where the injured employee has to be working.
Exactly. Such a requirement is not specifically
they can't both be out at
the employee claiming immunity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is suggested, and I think this case comes within that parameter. My client is not there for any purpose disassociated from his employment. He's there simply because he hasn't had the opportunity to leave. To say that he's not serving his employment, I think, or not serving his employer, I think, is a mistake. I think it's the wrong analysis also, but I think it's a mistake. He's there only because of his employment. He's there simply because he hasn't had the opportunity to leave. He's done nothing to disassociate himself from that employment.
Okay, let's change the facts ever so little. He backs up. He doesn't injure a fellow employee. He just, he's off the clock, he's leaving work, he backs down in his parking space, and he cracks one of the brand new rental cars with his personal vehicle instead of injuring a fellow employee. Now, who pays? Does his employer pay, or does his insurance pay
on his
personal vehicle?
I certainly envision a scenario where his employer is made a party that suit. The employer has.
But who, in your view, is legally responsible to pay? Same fact pattern we have here. Instead of personal injury,
just
one of eight runs
cars. I think a valid cause of action could be stated either against the driver or against the employer. The employer has the right to direct these fellows' activities. The employer can tell them where to park and where not to park. It's a matter of custom and practice with these gentlemen that a guard's car is always parked next to the shaft. If that spot is occupied, then they take another vacant spot in the AVA spot. But certainly, if the employer or the owner of the lot wanted them to be somewhere else, they would have the right to direct that activity. I think that's the case.
In this case, your client has immunity. Right? Okay. His client goes to his carrier and says, I got hit by an uninsured motorist. They're going to pay uninsured motorist coverage?
Well, you're bringing issues into the argument that are not presented by this case.
But it really is. 741 impacts that all the time because the answer always is, oh, no. He's immune. He's not uninsured. He was insured. We just don't pay. So the tortfeasor goes free. And that's why in the service is important.
I'm reluctant to argue that point because it's really not an issue presented by this case.
Well, doesn't this case present in the service?
Let me speak, if I may, about bad analysis and that phrase in the service, which is drawn from the definition of employee in the Act. I don't think this court should accept, I don't accept, the notion that in the service refers to the time or place or circumstances of the injury. I think it's clear, taken in the context of the entirety of the Act, that in the service of refers to in the employment of, just like you would think of it in the common parlance. It means it refers to the existence of an employment contract, not what that employee is doing at any given moment. I don't think the legislature intended that under the Workers' Compensation Act, a person is considered unemployed the second they clock out.
You really believe that? So that if I'm walking down the street in my neighborhood and one of my staff attorneys jumps the curb, hits me with his car, he's in my employment, but it's a Saturday and he's not working, he's not surely doing any research, except on how he can kill me at that point, he's immune?
I think that is one reading of the statute.
That's what you say the reading is.
He wouldn't be immune.
No, I don't agree with that.
He wouldn't be immune unless Justice Douglas was in
the scope. Let him answer the question,
will
you?
Right. And injured.
Go ahead, answer the question.
It is correct, Justice, he would not be immune unless you were also in the course. If the accident arose out of the course of...
I was on my way to the office.
complaint. I would still not, no, I would say that there are situations, taken to the extreme, where immunity would not apply. And I think that is one.
How do we write a rule, though, that says you have service to be very broad, it seems to me. How do we write a rule that gives any direction to this guy, how to apply it?
The two of them just made up my mind.
Isn't that something we should be doing?
Well, I think the rule needs to say that before immunity is proper, there needs to be more than a minimal nexus to that employment relationship. And you have a situation that clearly transcends industrial relations, such as Justice Butler described, that's a situation where immunity should not be afforded. The appellate court case that both parties discussed in the brief, the Cahill versus Jablonski case, that's a case that talks about an injury that occurs while one employee is engaged in a pickup game of stickball after work. That's a situation that clearly transcends industrial boundaries. They're not injured as part and parcel of the employment. They're injured because of somebody's horse play. And I think that the court in that case, I think, reached the right decision for the wrong reason. They latched onto this analysis in the service as referring to the time, place, and circumstances of the injury. I don't think that's the correct analysis. I think we just need to be looking at the nexus between the injury and the industrial relation. You have that in spades here. You have an injury that occurs after the situs of the employment, not nearby, not close to, not in a parking lot adjoining a factory. This accident occurs right on the spot where David Herron, minutes before the accident happened, had been doing the same sort of work that George Donnelly was doing. Mr. Alker seems to suggest that the accident could have happened only, or it happened at the site of employment only if Mr. Herron had backed up and run over the guard shack. Clearly, the guards are there to do something more than sit in the guard shack. They come out and they check rental contracts. They're charged with control of the parking lot. They control the vehicle entering and leaving the parking lot.
I didn't think Mr. Alker agreed with their charge to control the parking lot. That was the question asked earlier. I didn't think that was his answer. Is that in the record? They controlled the parking lot?
The record says they were charged with checking the contracts on vehicles, leaving the parking lot. Presumably they're there at the gate, they have a swing gate, and they control egress and exit, or exit and entrance to the parking lot. Mr. Herron also speaks in deposition about going out to investigate. There's suspicious activity on the lot, there's somebody lurking around, like trying to get into a vehicle. That's something they would be expected to get up and go investigate.
What kind of saw that? Places I've been to, the entrance is an entirely different place. You are checked out.
Situation here. You can envision a situation with a then you have a question of whether...
So it's the real estate that controls rather than the activity that your client is engaged in trying to actually
I think they go hand in hand in a way. I can envision a scenario where after leaving the guard shack and exchanging pleasantries with his successor, perhaps my guy walks into the airport and has a ham and cheese on rye and a Coke, come back and gets in his car. Has he broken the nexus with his employment then? Perhaps. I mean, it's a different case. I don't think I would be arguing immunity in that case. If he goes on a frolic to B4 and separates himself from the employment, I think you have a much different case than what you have here. In this case, he's only there because he hasn't yet had the opportunity to leave.
But if in the service of means something more than an employee, Mr. Alkire says that he has to be doing something to benefit the employer. If that's the right line, then you probably lose. That's, you think not, because he's still there at the site of employment, and you say he hasn't left yet.
I disagree with the analysis. I don't think in the service of him he is necessarily doing something at that point in time or at that place to benefit his employer. In the service of, I think, means that the employer has the right to tell him, you work from 8 till 5, and your buddy works from 5 until 12, and you come back Tuesday, and then you're off Wednesday, you come back Thursday. The employer has the right to direct this guy's activity to tell him when to be there and when not to be there. I think that's what in the service of means in that
definition. It's interesting that the definition of employer under B uses both words. It is employer that has in service one or more employees. That phrase is used twice, so that in the service of means something more than employee, I guess, or you could say that they're interchangeable, but it's sort of interesting language. Has in service one or more employees or the business.
Well, I think we're really parsing words, but I think they had to use some word other than employee to define employee. But I submit to the court that I don't think that definition means anything more than the common definition of employee that you find in Webster's. That means the person who works for another person. I see that my time's concluded. I thank the courts and I ask you to affirm the decision of the 8th District. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meeker. Mr. Alkire, you used your time. Let me take 30 seconds.
Thank you. There is another definition of employee in the code, in the chapter that immediately precedes the one at issue, and that's 4121.01A3. And when you read that definition, it doesn't use the words in the service of. But the one that does use those words is in the chapter that the immunity statute is a part of. Now, KDO happened on hours, during the hours of employment. It didn't happen after work. Mr. Heron admitted he was not in the service of his employer. The test, the bright line test, is one of respondeat superior, which is set forth in the Ward case that I cited out of Texas. That's the test, that's the rule that needs to be set forth so everyone in Ohio understands when an employee is entitled to the benefits of the immunity statute. There was no control exercised by Saggio over this parking lot. That's simply not in the record. That is a green. That is not part of the facts of why this case. I thank you very much for the privilege of hearing.
Thank you. The case is submitted to be advised for our attendees. Marshall, please turn it over.
All right.
Take a brief recess.